Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. You're listening to WDRT Community Radio from Viroqua, Wisconsin, 91.9 FM, and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can listen to podcasts of previous shows also. And my guest today is Mikael Ond, and he is from Dreamtime Village and grows perennial plants, mainly fruit and nut-bearing plants. And we're going to be talking about his business and, you know, what he has, how he does it, and how you can reach him, and things that you can do if you use the plants that he provides for you. So he's been doing this for many years and is located at West Lima, which would be sort of north and east of Viroqua, I guess. So welcome to the show, Mikael.
Yeah.
And his last name is, his last name is And.
And. Exactly.
Right. Mikael, you have been in the area a long time, I believe.
Yeah, I got here in 1990, so
okay.
I'm not a local because I'm still just first generation, but I've been here in the Griffiths longer than any place else in Wisconsin.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, 1990 sounds recent to me, but it's like 30 years ago.
It's 32 years
32.
Ago. 32. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, amazing. So I'm just interested in, you know, how you got started. And I know you've, you know, done presentations before, so you probably know what you'd like to say. But I just would like to know, you know, how you got into this plant propagating and, you know, what your interest is.
Well, when we happened onto the properties that later became Dreamtime Village, we basically were given a part of West Lima, which included a lot of different properties where we could do all kinds of things. And at the same time, this is 1990, and at the same time, we also discovered permaculture, which was not well known in the Midwestern Wisconsin, but permaculture was a big thing in Australia, a little bit in southwestern United States, in the Northeast and stuff. And it really was starting to pick up steam, and so we learned a lot about kind of what the possibilities of perennial agriculture were about as opposed to annual agriculture. And that really became a focus, kind of what we were doing at the community, at Dreamtime Village itself, and also for myself also. I had, I lived previously in Madison with my first wife, Lix, and we did a little bit of growing and gardening, but we lived on Willie Street, and there was no place. In order to have plants in Willie Street, we built boxes and found soil from someplace else, put soil in boxes and grew gourds in boxes. So that's my entrance into growing all kinds of crazy things. But then when we got out here and had all this land, all of a sudden the potential was just tremendous for just doing all kinds of things. We created the first year that we were at Dreamtime, we had a permaculture design course, which are these long courses. At that point, they were 17 days long, and we had a permaculture design course at Dreamtime where we invited in probably 20 different teachers, and we had more than 40 students. At that point, they were just like these intense classes and stuff, which everyone in the class made a permaculture design of the property. And so after the course was over, we had like 40 different designs for the property surrounding where the Dreamtime properties are, which is at that point was this old school in West Lima that had 3 acres in the back of the school, which actually used to be a baseball diamond, and at the point we moved here had nothing growing back there. It was like a yard.
Oh, great.
And so these designs just all of a sudden like catapulted us into the world of just like what the possibilities were, as well as like helping us personally as our community formulate what sorts of things we wanted to do. And the kind of functions that we finally decided were that, well, the first thing is we wanted to be able to grow perennial fruit, nuts, berries, herbs, and medicinals for the community itself to be used. And then we also wanted to make a demonstration so people could see what a forest garden sort of a permaculture edible landscaping design would look like. Yeah, and they take time. They don't appear overnight. A lot of the fruit trees take 5, 10, 15 years before they're fruitful and stuff. So it was a long-term sort of process to kind of put everything in place. But at a certain point, and one of the other functions that we wanted to do is we wanted to create a repository. And so before, like I started selling nursery plants about 2010, but for about 15, 20 years, we just let people come to our permaculture demonstration and make cuttings or collect seed or get different kinds of genetics that existed there and did it all for free for almost 20 years and stuff. And then when I was, for a lot of the time I was working in Organic Valley, but then I left my job at Organic Valley and decided, well, I want to make my living selling plants at the farmer's market in Viroqua, which is a pretty steep challenge. At that point, it wasn't a really large kind of farmer's market. But I've actually been able in the summers to usually generate enough income and stuff from just selling on Saturdays in the Viroqua farmer's market. And it's kind of been a long, long journey to get there. One of the other functions of the community, or of the plantings and stuff that came eventually, was that all of a sudden there was like way more kinds of fruit stuff that we could consume at the time, or you know, consume right away. And so we had to start getting into preservation, putting things up. And then that's the point where I started getting into winemaking, because obviously a lot of the fruit were perfect for making wine. And that really became much more of my focus. And then in 2010, I bought another property that's different from Dreamtime. It's halfway between Lafarge and Viroqua, and that was a 40-acre vineyard where I've been focusing on planting things which make really good wine and stuff in Wisconsin. So at that vineyard, I have grapes, apples, pears, pawpaws, peaches, plums, elderberries, rhubarb, different kinds of currants, all things which make really, really good wine.
You do have your job cut out for you.
Yeah, my toes are dipping in a lot of pots of water.
Right. Well, isn't it great to be older and wiser? I mean, you just have a lot of experience now.
You know what? When I do presentations for people about growing, my presentations are usually called utilizing paradise gardening, utilizing underused plants. And the first thing I usually tell people when I'm standing in front of everybody is I look at everyone and I say, I've killed more plants than all you people combined.
Makes me feel better.
One of the ways I talk about that is that before I started doing all this, and it's also another part of my life, is I'm an experimental artist, and I do experimental poetry, experimental performance art, experimental music, all very, very cutting-edge things. And I've taken the same approach to the way that I do permaculture and growing. I'm not interested in doing giant fields of one thing or things that people have already done. I'm really, really focused on doing at being kind of like a cutting edge and experimenting and finding what possible things can be done that aren't being done here and helping kind of strategize and get those things established. So a couple of my focuses are I grow figs. And I'm pretty much the only person in Wisconsin that sells fresh, local, organic figs, and I've done a lot of experimentation with what the best kinds of figs are and different ways of doing them. I'm also passionate about getting pawpaw patches established anywhere around the area in the Driftless. We're about 200 miles north of the native range of pawpaws, but with a little bit of design and thinking and the correct cultivars, it is totally possible to have a pawpaw patch in your backyard around here. The third thing that I have a lot of focus on is that I'm working on breeding a true Zone 4 hardy peach. Now, this is a peach that should actually be hardy even in northern parts of Wisconsin where no one grows peaches and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I've been working with about 30 years selectively breeding a kind of peach called Siberian Sea Peach. And so they're precocious from a pit. They will, if you plant a pit, in 3 years it will be a tree that's flowering and producing fruit.
Oh my goodness.
It allows you to do selective breeding over a short period of time. You know, like for instance, if you plant an apple seed, it could take 15, 20 years before the apple has any fruit. So these kinds of peaches are really, really fun for planting, getting in the ground, selecting, you know, and over the five generations that I've planted these peaches, the peaches have gotten larger, they've gotten cleaner, they've got less disease. The trees seem to be more vigorous. So it really is something that, and it's something that people can continue ad infinitum into the future, just always selecting the best ones and growing those out. And one of the things that it's doing with things like pawpaws and peaches is that it's acclimating those genetics to our exact area.
Right.
And as weather and temperature and all these things become really radicalized and extreme, this kind of approach helps this stuff get established.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that takes a lot of time, though, growing things from seed and then selecting the best and then, you know, saving
exactly.
those seed. I mean, it just takes years, decades.
Patience. Wow. You know, and I also grow, you know, nut trees, but with nuts, they're way, way long. You know, like a lot of my nuts that I grow take, 7, 8, 15 years before they have nuts and stuff. So I'm doing less kind of breeding and selecting with those, but I'm still passionate about, you know, I'm still planting at the age of 64. I'm still planting nut trees that take 20 years before they're even have nuts.
Oh gosh! Well, we'll go on forever. Well, you know, I kind of want to go back right to the very beginning and really kind of discuss what permaculture is. And I just want to let people know that I'm talking to Mikkel Arndt. He has just learned by experience and by growing and killing and making mistakes. And, he's really at the age now. He's really has a lot of experience with this. But, you know, I'm not sure if I know what is meant by permaculture. There may be a number of things that are considered part of permaculture. And you have a couple of parrots in the background, I think, Mikkel.
Yeah, they hear me talking, so they want to be on the radio, apparently.
Aw. So, anyway, could you tell us what permaculture, kind of
is? Well, everyone is going to tell you something different.
Yeah.
There are schools of permaculture, and there are schools of permaculture where it's permaculture with a capital P, and it's a very, very specific kind of thing. And those type of folks tend to say lots of other things aren't permaculture. I tend to have a much more loose usage of the term, because a lot of the concepts in permaculture actually come from indigenous agriculture that's thousands of years old.
Okay.
So permaculture is really a way to organize a lot of knowledge about the natural world into a more modern form.
Mm-hmm.
It focuses on perennial systems that model nature. So, So one of the things that I found out here is, and I get this all the time at the farmer's market, is people are telling me they're doing permaculture, and they're talking about growing tomatoes in their backyard. And so most people wouldn't necessarily think of that as a permaculture thing. As gardening, it's fine to call it gardening, but permaculture is really a much more sort of polyculture kind of approach, where you're growing things in guilds, where different kinds of plants that go together grow in association with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You're also mimicking different kinds of natural biomes. So, for instance, there's folks in this area that are doing chestnuts and hazelnuts and those kinds of things as permaculture, and they are trying to mimic an oak savanna, which is one of the natural sort of biomes in the upper Midwest. There is also ways of doing permaculture where you're doing forest gardening. So you're actually doing multiple, you know, it's not horizontal, it's vertical. So your overstory species is some sort of larger tree. Most likely it's some sort of nut tree or some sort of tree that has some sort of economic use. There's other kinds of things other than nuts and fruit that would make sense within a permaculture design. And then underneath the tall sorts of trees, and you have your smaller trees, which are more like fruit trees, and then under those you have the tall bushes, and under those you have the lower bushes, under those you have things like vines, ground cover, woody perennials, woody herbs and medicinals. So what you're doing is, rather than like spreading things out in a flat way, you're creating a three-dimensional sort of paradise. And the trick, of course, is that there's lots of different issues with weather hardiness, sun exposure, rain, drought, you name it. So all these things factor into how a design comes together.
Mm-hmm. Now, I always thought that permaculture often included animals.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of folks, I mean, you have different approaches. Mm-hmm. There's also a huge vegan kind of approach to permaculture. So, of course, they're trying to do a different sort of permaculture that's mm-hmm. all plant-based. But a lot of folks in this area have sort of departed from calling it permaculture and are much more interested in thinking of it as regenerative agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And those projects are almost all animal-based. So the animals sort of create the nutrient cycle for the property and stuff just through their, you know, manure and compost and so forth.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. So, right, providing food for animals, and they might even be farm animals, or they might be, you know,
right,
wild native animals, or
And then at Dreamtime we had goats and chickens and ducks and that kind of stuff for many, many years mm-hmm. when we had more folks living here. But just because we have a problem with a neighbor who has crazy hound dogs that kill all of our animals, we stopped having animals here at Dreamtime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some way, having animals in your design is like having children. It's a commitment that is, you're committed to it every day. You can't, like, walk away from it. So,
right.
It's a different kind of approach. Some people want to be able to come and go and stuff, and want a kind of design that allows them to maybe be there on weekends or when they're not working, or maybe it's in a different place from where they live, you know. And so those are not good fits for an animal-based sort of
right.
design.
Right. Okay. There's several things. I want to go in a million directions from this, but tell us just a little bit about Dreamtime.
Let me just start with the name. Dreamtime, the name Dreamtime comes from the Aborigine Australian Dreamtime. And the Aborigine Australians are the oldest continuous culture on the planet, people say going back to 60,000 years. And their spirituality is called the Dreamtime. And in that spirituality, they believe that their waking hours are their dreaming hours, and their dreaming hours are the waking hours. So they've flipped the dominant paradigm of a reality.
Okay.
And so that's something that we were interested in, because we really wanted to have our community be not like the rest of the world. We want to put new things into place. One other thing that was really interesting about the concept of Dreamtime is that in a lot of the Aboriginal languages, they don't have words that separate their creative things, like painting and dancing and music instruments and that kind of stuff, from hunting and eating and so forth. So it's all on the language level, on the conceptual level, it's all integrated in a much, much different way than the Western world. And so we were coming to Dreamtime as being artists in Madison. We wanted to really bring a lot of that creativity to just, you know, homesteading and being out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that became the reason why we chose the word Dreamtime.
Mm-hmm.
When we started, mm-hmm. we originally had the use of a 28,000 square foot school in West Lima. So for 15 years or so, the school was more the focus. So we would do a lot of sort of weekend classes. We had a lot of different people who came in and sort of did different kinds of arts projects and stuff in the school, or set up a studio, or we ran a pottery for a while and dug clay in the backyard and made earthenware from it, made music instruments from the clay. We had lots of different kinds of events, and we're much more focused on being sort of a public venue. And also in the summers had a lot more folks here. At some points in the 90s, we had up to 25 people living here. And then things changed around 2000, where the school got moisture inside and just was not a safe building to bring kids into and have events in and stuff. And we sort of weaned ourselves from using the building, which totally changed the complexion of the community. It became much more, where the focus was much more like a co-housing kind of thing rather than, you know, having a lot of classes and stuff. And then the other thing that happened in 2004 is that my first wife, Lix, who her and I were sort of the main the main directors and stuff in the community. She died suddenly of cancer, and she was always the front person and the hostess. So, and I'm more of a behind-the-scenes person, so that, more than anything, changed what Dreamtime became or has become.
I'm really sorry about that. And, you know, I did know Lix, and I didn't really realize that, you know, you were partners. I didn't really realize that. So, yeah, that was very sad and sudden. She went pretty quickly.
Yeah, less than a month.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's really hard. And to pick up and start again.
Oh, and it just, you know, I can be social sometimes, but no one will ever call me a social butterfly. I'm just the kind of person who just, like, people instantly were enamored with her when they met her. And unfortunately, part of her thing, and I'm convinced, is that it really used... She gave of herself without taking care of herself a lot of times. Because
mm-hmm.
like, there were always people coming here and showing up. We had buses showing up in the middle of the night. I mean, it just was like a crazy time. And she was always there for everyone. And, you know, I just reached a point toward the end of her life where she wanted to do other things, and she started pulling away. But then as she started pulling away, then this happened with the cancer, the pancreatic
mm-hmm.
cancer.
Oh, dear. That is just so sad.
Yep.
You know, what do you have now? Do you have people living there? What is the living situation?
There's seven people living here.
Are they outdoors?
Over,
or are
the
they...
last, over the last 30 years, we've lost three houses to fire, so we have we have a lot less sort of living quarters and stuff.
Oh.
We'd like to be rejuvenated. I mean, one of the things that the folks are here are mostly older, and that's one of the things about a long-term community is we need younger folks to kind of come in and find a way to be committed to the project in a way that they'd be here for a long time, but also just start, you know, taking over doing things and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm also involved in doing in my vineyard and stuff, which is not part of Dreamtime, it's my own project, and so that takes up a lot of my energy, and so I'm less and less motivated to try to do projects at Dreamtime because I just have my hands mm-hmm. in other things as well.
Well, there might be listeners who would be very interested, so let's explain how they can get in touch with you.
Well, honestly, the one thing is the website at dreamtimevillage.org hasn't been changed in 15 or years or more, so that's a bad, I mean, it's a way to get a hold of us, but it's a bad way. I mean, the information is like, really outdated and stuff. We're on Facebook, and I'm on Facebook as Mikael Ande, and we're on a Facebook page as Dreamtime Village. I also have a Facebook page as Triple Sacred Grove, so people can contact me that way.
So say also, those again. Driftless Sacred Grove.
That's a page on Facebook.
Okay.
And then there's a Dreamtime Village Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And then my personal page is just under Mikael And.
Mm-hmm. M-I-C-H.
Nope. M-I-E-K-A-L. Mikael.
Oh, okay. M-I-E-K-A-L. Well,
A-L. M-I-E-K-A-L.
Well, okay, so if you looked up Mikael, you need to know how to spell it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's interesting is I changed my name when I was a teenage poet, and I was born Michael Anderson, and I looked in the Chicago phone book when I was 13 years old, and there were 325 Michael Andersons, and there were 12 Michael David Andersons, and I had an intense identity crisis and changed my name to Mikael
mm-hmm.
because I was a writer and I wanted to have a new name. And it turns out that when the Internet started, Mikael, M-I-E-K-A-L, for many, many years was a unique search string where my stuff was the only things that showed up when you searched those string of letters. So it was kind of a good premonition of a way to change my name.
Oh, very, very interesting. Yeah. So, you know, I was personally interested. I've seen you at the farmer's market many times, but I really haven't spent much time talking with you. But my interest was like, I've got some open space that used to be a big garden, and now it's not being used, and I don't really, I'm kind of loath to turn it into just something to mow. I've got plenty of acres to mow. So, you know, just personally, I was interested. What could I do? How could I get a plan? What might I want to try to do with that? You know, maybe a half acre. Where do you begin?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I'm constantly doing is reminding people to think about how would they use it? What do they want? What would they do with it after they have it?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to plant stuff, but you're not going to pick it, you're not going to use it, you're not going to turn it into things. In some ways, then maybe you're just doing a wildlife cover, and so that determines what the best designs are. If you're just mm-hmm. going to let it go wild and, you know, have the animals come and take it. If you're actually going to use things, then it needs to be based on which things you have interest in using mm-hmm. and have time to use and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about fruit and nuts and berries is they don't care what your timetable is. You know, there'll be unripe, 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 and then suddenly they're ripe and need to be picked and taken care
exactly.
of. And it depends on so many different factors. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, there tends to be, you know, just because I've observed things over years, there tends to be, sometimes a 2 to 3 week variation from year to year when those things are ripe. So you can't even plan ahead of time when you're going to pick the pears or when you're going to pick the berries, stuff like that. You have to be out there. You have to be checking the fruit. And now that we have, like, Japanese beetles and other sorts of invasive insects in the area, there's even more things to calculate, when you're going to pick stuff.
Right. Well, that's really important, and I got a book that is just delightful, and it's I don't even know if you could get it anymore, but it's Summer Kitchens from in the Ukraine.
Whoa!
And
I haven't heard of that.
Oh, and it's wonderful, and it really meets the need of people here who like have a couple of fruit trees or something like that, and you suddenly have bushels of pears or apples. It's not like going to the store or the farmer's market and buying a few. It's like, hey, you just got it, and you've got to harvest it, and you've got to figure out how to preserve it. You pickle it, you dry it, you smoke it, whatever you do, you know, make wine out of it. So it was a fun book to find because it was kind of addressed the needs of people who have producing, not just gardens, but fruit and nut trees and everything. So, yeah, it's a cute...
I think one of the for a lot of folks who are interested in homestead-based kind of permaculture designs, one of the best existing examples, and it goes back hundreds of years, is people's yards in Eastern Europe. It's just absolute. My second wife was Romanian, and so we spent more than a month in Romania seeing a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to these little villages and stuff, every single yard has a plum tree, has a apple tree, has a bunch of different, you know, things like rhubarb and asparagus and all these different kinds of things growing. And they do annual vegetables as well, but it's like every yard is its own grocery store. And no one there thinks twice about it because their parents did it, their grandparents did it. For hundreds of years, they've been doing the same thing with this stuff. Now, admittedly, in Romania, a lot of the fruits get turned into booze, but, you know, there's other ways to put it up, too. You don't necessarily have to make wine or distill alcohol from it. You can make juices. You can make other kinds of jams and jellies and so forth.
Oh, can you recommend some books on this or resources?
No. I mean, there probably is books out there. I'm on a lot of different Facebook groups that have Eastern Europeans, I just see pictures of their yards. I wish there was more details and stuff about it, but it's really like a fascinating kind of thing because it's not. And also their culture, you know, like one of the things that's happened in urban spaces in our country is that 20 years ago, in most cities and urban spaces, you couldn't grow fruit in your yard. I mean,
there's a law against it,
so forth, against having anything that made the ground messy or that your neighbors might complain about. And so there's been a huge sort of liberalization of policies related to edible landscaping. I lived in Madison in the 80s, and in 1980, when I lived there, hardly anyone had edible landscaping in their yard. And now you go to Madison, and there are hundreds of yards that have wildflower landscapes. They have lots of fruit trees and things like that. There's a lot more initiative in the different parks and stuff to have fruit and so forth growing. It's really gone a long way. And even in Viroqua, you know, 10 years ago when I first started to do a market, I'd constantly have people come into market complaining that, you know, they received a note from the city or something that they couldn't do that thing, or that something in the boulevard was more than 36 inches high, or, you know, all these kind of silly things.
Yeah, right. Well, we just have this idea here that the yard has to be just be mowed.
Yeah, in Eastern Europe, it has this huge long tradition that it would be the opposite. Like if you had a place in Romania and you were mowing all your grass and there was nothing but maybe one shade tree or something in your yard, people would just think that you were very, very weird.
I know.
So it's kind of like the complete opposite of what we have here.
I know. I was in the Republic of Georgia a few years ago and got to be in a smaller town. Their yard was just like that. I mean, they just had, I think you could have cut the yard, the lawn with a sickle. I mean,
right.
It was just a little bit of grass, but mainly it was, like you say, a tree, one or two trees of different kinds of fruit, and, you know, and then just had the barbecue pit, you know, right along in the garden. And, you know, in France, they call it a jardin. It is a garden. I think they say that also in Britain. I mean, garden, they don't say yard, they say garden.
It's
I love that idea of the grocery store in your yard. I'm already thinking about, you know, maybe I'll do things differently now. But anyway, I'm talking with Mikael Ahnd, and he is, and you say and Mikael Ahnd. And it's Mikel, and he has a Facebook pages on Dreamtime Village and Driftless Sacred Grove, and Mikael, and so you could, you know, connect with him, or at the Viroqua Farmers Market.
It's a great place to meet.
Yep. And so, and you have tried to grow things that I think some people aren't used to, like pawpaws. I don't know what pawpaws are. They grow in the south, and you're trying to bring them further north. And what about these other berries and things, aronia? You know, people don't even know what they are. So can you tell what you have and what you might do with them?
Well, with pawpaws are the only subtropical fruit that grows in the upper Midwest. So a pawpaw looks kind of like a green mango, and it tastes like a mango crossed with a banana. The most northern native patches of pawpaws are around Quad Cities. So we're a good 200 miles north, and we're a good USDA zone colder than that area. So, and then our seasons are shorter. So one of the things about growing pawpaws in our area is that you have to make sure you're growing a variety or a cultivars that are short season ripeners. There's a lot of pawpaws that require, 220 days of season, and we obviously don't have that here. Mm-hmm. So you need to focus on a couple different varieties that ripen earlier. My pawpaw patch here in our permaculture demonstration was planted in 1999, and it during the polar vortexes, the fruit gets knocked back for the following year, but the trees themselves stay alive.
Oh, okay.
And this is actually true for a lot of the sort of zone 5 fruit that is being grown here. On the super cold years, you're not, you know, your fruit buds on your trees are going to get hammered, but you just hope that the wood of the trees themselves is hardy enough to make it through.
Oh, okay.
Like if you're in a cold area, one of the things is about placement, like where are you going to plant. So, for instance, a lot of things like the peaches and the pawpaws would not do well in the cold, dark valleys of the Driftless. The season is much shorter there than it is on the ridges. The cold settles in more in the winter. The environment is just a little bit more extreme than they can tolerate. And plus, you know, just the season being shorter. An example I have is that here at West Lima, if you go to the north side of West Lima and down the hill, a distance of less than a half a mile. Sometimes the freeze date in the fall, the first freeze date in the fall is September 15th. And in the same year, my freeze date could be November 1st.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's just one end of the season. So so literally, I can have more than 2 months longer growing season than a half a mile down the hill into the dark part of the valley.
Oh.
So if people are, like, looking for properties or trying to get set up, one of the and you want to grow a lot of fruit, nuts, and berries and stuff like that, I highly recommend looking for properties that have either a ridge top or toward the top of a ridge, say over 1,100 or 1,150 feet, you know, up in the air a bit, for situating their nurseries or their plantings. And then one of the other things that helps, obviously, is that during the flood events, the water runs away from you.
Right. We grew grapes, and I kept talking about you need to have good drainage. You got to have good air drainage. You know.
Yeah, almost all fruit needs good drainage. I mean, some fruit will do well on soggy soils, but in general, one of the things that happens on those kind of soils is you attract a lot more disease to your planting. So good drainage is absolutely essential.
Well, speaking of that, I'm thinking you haven't used the word organic, but I'm sure that really basically you're trying to grow without, you know, artificial, inputs.
I mean, I worked for Organic Valley for many years, so I'm kind of a very very strong proponent of organic with a small O. I'm not really into the corporate sort of monopolization of organic as an exclusive term, but just in terms of approaches, my vineyard is no spray, so I don't even spray organic sprays. So I work much more with cultivar selection, choosing the cultivars that are most disease resistant, the most, you know. So sometimes, let me give an example. I don't grow apples, but this is just an example. A lot of folks that come to me in the farmers market talk about growing Honeycrisp apples because they see Honeycrisp apples in the grocery store, and they're kind of like how people used to think of delicious apples. They're thought of like the best apples, so people want to grow those. Well, if you grow a Honeycrisp apple in the upper Midwest, if you want an apple that looks like a perfect apple, you are going to be spraying over and over and over all summer long different kinds of sprays and stuff to keep your stuff looking clean, as opposed to a place like Turkey Ridge, which does a lot of no spraying. They plant varieties like Liberty and Priscilla and Enterprise, which are no spray. The apples aren't necessarily perfect, but they're certainly clean enough for eating. They're obviously clean enough for making cider and vinegar and stuff, and they're far better choices for people to plant. Because when it comes down to it, if you're just growing some fruit in your backyard and you're not like a super gardener and you're not like really committed to all the technology of growing, you're probably not going to spray stuff. You're probably going to hope that you have varieties that kind of, and at least in most years, have usable fruit without a lot of intervention. And that is all about knowledge, like what things do best here and what kind of situation those things do best in.
My one big apple tree, which I think is a wealthy, it's gotten better and better. It used to just have all kinds of worms and things like that. Now these later crops have been really nice apples and larger, and I haven't been spraying because they're full-size trees, and I just can't even manage them. And same with my pears. They seem to be doing fine without any kind of spray, which I'm happy because I'm just not going to do that. I'm not up to it, so... I guess, you know, if you grow dwarf trees, those aren't really natural in a way.
Well, no, they're not. I mean, all apple trees are grafted onto woodstock, so the trees themselves are quote natural. The only thing that's different is that they're grafted onto different kind of woodstock. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the one thing about a dwarf tree, which they're good fits for urban environments, but they also... Like, a dwarf apple tree isn't going to live for 200 years, whereas a standard apple tree will just, like, live forever.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And they bear faster, but they also kind of wear out faster.
Okay, well, let's talk about some other things. Now, some of the berries and nuts that you have. What have you been working on?
You mentioned Aronia, so I'll talk. I've been growing Aronia for many, many years, and I think it's really an interesting fruit. One of the interesting things to me is because it's not a fresh-eating fruit, it's very astringent, it has a pretty intense mouthfeel, so people aren't going to just eat them like a blueberry, even though they look like blueberries. But nutritionally, Aronia is just a powerhouse. I joke that Aronia makes blueberries look like junk food. It really, it kind of, you know, like if you look at a tradition or a nutritional index of them, in most categories, Aronia has a lot more of the different nutrients and stuff, mm-hmm. and as well as the anthocyanins. And so it really is about learning how to use it and finding ways that you can integrate it into your diet. Mm-hmm. One of the fabulous things for Aronia is, first of all, it's native in Wisconsin, and generally most fruits that we grow are, you know, they're from Central Asia. They're not, you know, apples, pears, peaches, apricots. All those are all none of them are native.
No.
And so one of the nice things is growing some fruits like Aronia and serpentberry that are actually native and learning how to use them.
Can you spell Aronia for us before?
A-R-O-N-I-A.
Okay.
And
how come we don't know about these?
Aronia. You know, I've never had any disease. I've never had any problems with getting the fruit. It's really like it's one of those things you can put in the ground and forget about it, and just try to pick it when it's ripe. And I also have the thing where the birds don't even go after it. As you know, like with serviceberry, the problem you have with serviceberry is that the birds are sitting in trees with binoculars waiting for the fruit to be ripe, and then they hammer it immediately. So if you can pick your serviceberries, you're exceedingly lucky, mm-hmm. Without netting and stuff. Aronia tends not to have so much bird pressure and stuff, and it's super easy to pick. We picked some Aronia last week, and I think I picked 5 gallons in about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And my hands are completely dark purple when it's done. And it actually picks it. As you pick, you can actually, the stems stay on the bush, so you're actually de-stemming at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So the berries are ready to go. The thing that I recommend for folks, there's lots of different ways to use it, but one of the easiest ways is you get the berries picked, and then you just put them in freezer bags, put them in your freezer, and then anytime you're making a smoothie or baked goods or you want a bit of fruit in something, then you could just pull them out of the freezer, and they're good to go. And mm-hmm. I have Aronia berries in the freezer for a couple of years. Both my parrots are addicted to them, so I feed a lot of them to my parrots.
Well, now, how would Aronia berries be in baked goods? I mean...
Well, you know, they're astringent, but once you bake them and they're combined with the ingredients of your muffins or baked goods or something like that, the astringency disappears, essentially. You don't necessarily notice it. And they have a very fruity flavor. The flavor is a little bit different than blue. I mean, one of the things is that our mouths are sort of tuned to specific flavors from being kids and stuff, so you almost have to teach yourself how to appreciate the flavors of something that we're not familiar with. And it's a learning process, but I also think that there's in our area, there's a huge initiative, like because of the organic movement and because of foodies and different things, where people are open to learning new things and trying new things and finding ways that, you know, maybe 50 years down the line, there won't be a leap to get to that point. It'll just be ingrained in our culture at that point. Aronia also has a lot of proponents. There's a Aronia Association, I believe it's a cooperative it's a 5-state area, and so they have a giant, a lot of folks were putting in, you know, 40-acre places or 40-acre plantings of Aronia and doing, you know, for commercial production. And this co-op also is doing a lot of sort of product discovery,
uh-huh.
you know,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of different things, Aronia ice cream, Aronia chutney, different kinds of Aronia sauces.
So is this something that you could grow it on your farm, and I don't know, how would you get it from your farm to, you know, would they buy your product?
Well, I, you know, for that kind of thing, you'd have to be part of the association, mm-hmm. and you would create a contract with them for them to use and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is still true, but a few years ago, Trader Joe's was using 10% aronia in their cherry juice. You can imagine how much aronia that would be to supply all, you know, 10% of the juice for all of Trader Joe's cherry juice.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some markets out there, and I'm, you know, a lot of these things. The market changes, like there's an initial sort of excitement, a lot of folks get into it, and then the market kind of backs down and some people back out, but there's still more of the people who are a little bit more committed, who just keep sort of hammering away at it to make it more integrated into our society and stuff.
Well, it's is there such a thing as mechanical picking then for these things? If you're growing acres,
I'm not sure about that answer, but I think I read that some people are taking blueberry pickers and changing them around a bit.
Mm-mm.
And a lot of the mechanical picking things, I think, is also. I mean, aronia is big in Eastern Europe as well, so I think maybe a lot of the mechanical picking things are more sort of European based.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually know the answer. I don't, you know, I have maybe 200 bushes, but I pick them all by hand and stuff.
You do. Well, I was thinking about that. If you're older and you're moving out in the country to retire and you're growing hazelnuts or something like that, you really got to think about, how am I going to pick all these things?
Yeah,
who's going to
yeah.
do this for me?
Yeah, if you're growing hazelnuts, you're going to think, how am I going to shell all these without mechanical shelling?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, really, of course, we have the American Hazelnut Company right here in, you know.
Yep.
Gaze Mills. So, yeah, it is helpful for farmers to come together, growers to come together and find a way to, you know, pick, process, market, and everything, you know, because just by yourself you can't. But that's a little bit different from really the permaculture idea, isn't it?
Yeah, because, those kinds of things get much more into monoculture.
No,
planting.
Yeah.
So, in lots of ways, like I said, I'm not interested in scaling things up. I'm much more interested in kind of experimenting and continuing to try new things and stuff, and then just getting folks turned on to how to use these. You know, the thing with aronia that I am biggest proponent of is aronia makes fabulous wine and mead, and is super easy to ferment. It doesn't, I mean, literally, you can use a steam juicer and make the juice and cut it with some water and add sugar and yeast, and it makes a really cool wine. The longer it ages, the less astringent it becomes. If you're concerned about... Now, one of the things that happens with aronia is that, a traditional thing in wines is to have tannins and stuff in your wine. So the astringency sort of works like a tannin in the same way. And you can control that tannin by back sweetening and stuff like that. If it's like too tannic, you could add some sweetener to your wine or to your mead, and that'll make it less sort of astringent. Oh, sorry.
Well, we are doing this interview by phone, and Mikhail has two parrots.
Two, yeah. Two
oh, so parrots, yeah. We're hearing them in the background, but that's sweet. Well, yeah, the wine. Well, you whipped through winemaking in 30 seconds. anybody who... I guess you can just go online and figure out how to make wine. Or there's just all kinds of books on making
there's
wine.
Many, many approaches to wine. You know, there's also other kinds of ferments that you don't necessarily have to make a high alcohol ferment.
Okay.
You can do something with, like, ginger bug.
Oh, do that,
which
yes.
Which creates more like a kombucha-type thing. So it has a fizz and a little bit of... You know, it doesn't taste alcoholic, but it usually has about 1-2% sort of alcohol in it.
Oh, that's
but it finishes really fast. You know, usually in 21 days or even less, it's ready to drink.
Well, can you go into a little more detail about how you'd make something like that?
Okay, well, a ginger bug is a kind of a SCOBY, like kombucha, but it's way different, where you just take... The way you start out is you take a tablespoon of ginger and you mince it up fine, and you add a tablespoon of water and a tablespoon of sugar, and then you put that in a jar, and then each day you're going to feed that, and then after 4 or 5 days it's active enough that you can add it to a juice, and it will start activating the juice.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And the juice gets kind of fizzy. If you ha- have to watch out if you're using, like, if you're putting them into swing tops, that if you want to put it in the refrigerator, you want to keep it cool when you open it. If you would, you know, it becomes pressurized in the swing top, and if you let it outside, it gets to room temperature, and then you open up the swing top, the whole bottle is going to sort of spew out because it's so active and stuff. So you have to really make sure you have it at cold temperature when you open it. And they're very quick, you know. I mean, in some ways, you know, some people call them a soda. In some ways, they're really just a different approach to a soda and stuff. And then, of course, you can control the sweetness. Like, I tend to like dry things, so I don't make things sweet and stuff like that, but some folks like to have sweetness, so you just control that by having more sugar or honey or sweetener in it.
It's a natural carbonation.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And the ginger bug is a really fun one to work with because it's very, very active, and it works in a lot of things. I actually use it for wine making as well, but ginger bug only has alcohol tolerance of about 9%, so it doesn't usually, you know, people consider wines to start at 11% alcohol, so it doesn't really get you to the level of a wine, so sometimes I'll have to use another yeast or something just to ferment it a little more, but it creates a very specific kind of body and sort of a back taste and stuff that I can usually recognize when something's been fermented with a ginger bug.
I just want to make sure that you know that you're listening to WDRT Community Radio 91.9. This is Who's in the Kitchen. We're on every Saturday at noon. And we also have podcasts of previous shows, and you might want to listen to this. I've been talking with Michael and Mikkel, of the Dreamtime Farm in West Lima. And we still have a few more minutes, but just wanted to let you know. And you might want to listen to this show again and tell your friends. Mikkel, you have anything more that you wanted to add about different things that you grow and share? And well, I know one of the things I'm interested in is just propagation. I mean, what are the ways that you do propagate plants?
One of the other things that I do is that in the cold months, I actually make my living selling cuttings of plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what that means, they've dropped their leaves and they've gone dormant, but there's a lot of the fruit plants can be generated by either cuttings or scion wood. Now, a cutting is something that can be put in potting soil and rooted just on the cutting itself. And then scion wood, of course, is a cutting that requires being grafted to a rootstock. So, for instance, pears and apples, and some people do peaches and apricots and so forth, but pears and apples, you buy a scion wood, and then in the spring you would graft it to a rootstock to make a new plant. But things like currants, grapes, elderberries, actually, some people are doing it now with these kind of white peaches that I grow, willows, dogwoods, all different kinds of things. You take a cutting and you put it in potting soil. Figs is another one. Put it in potting soil, and you basically have a clone of the existing plant. And so there's a technology to rooting stuff as cuttings. Some things are very, very easy. Things like currants and elderberries root very, very easily. Other things, like for instance, kiwis, which I grow, kiwis are a little bit more complicated to root from cuttings, but they are certainly possible. It's just you have to kind of, once again, you learn by killing things and experimentation what works and what doesn't work.
Well, now, can all of these be planted outside, or some of these really you will grow them inside, or
well,
what?
Everything except for the figs grows outside. And actually, I have some figs growing outside next to my house. But in general, a fig doesn't really do well growing outside north of Zone 6B, Zone 7, so central United States. People do different things to grow them outside. But I grow most of my figs in containers. Everything else I grow outside.
Well, do you have a greenhouse or hoop house?
I have a hoop house, yeah. And actually, I call it a fig house because it's 70 feet by 30 feet is devoted just to fig growing. So I one half of the hoop house has 80 varieties of figs in containers, and then the back half of the fig house I have figs planted into the ground, so I don't have to, you know, I don't have to move them in the winter or anything. It's an unheated hoop house, so at night or during the winter when it's not sunny, it's the same temperature as outside. So the only, you know, like for the in-ground stuff, when the trees go dormant in October, what I'm doing is I'm taking the fig trees and I cut them back to the totally to the ground, and then I put hay bales on top of them, and then that is usually enough so that the ground beneath the hay bale does not freeze during the winter, like even when it's 20 below outside, because what happens is even though the greenhouse isn't heated at night, during the day it absorbs temperature and it keeps the ground inside the hoop house from freezing hard. It only sort of freezes lightly, and then that allows the fig trees to survive.
Oh, I see. Because fig trees, it would be more than just the bud that freezes. It would be the roots.
Oh, everything. Yeah. If it wasn't protected, everything would freeze.
And, right.
And a fig tree can't really freeze hard.
Yeah, right. Do you sell figs in the area?
Fig fruit or fig trees?
Fig fruit.
Well, on the good years, I sell them at the farmer's market. Yeah,
uh-huh.
I think this year I might have some. It's a late. The season's late, but usually I'll have some toward the end of my time at the farmer's market.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's pretty cool. Well, it's a fun stand there at the farmer's market to see all the different kinds of things you're growing. I'm so glad that you've been on the show, Mikkel. I've been talking with Mikkel and from Dreamtime Farm, and also called
Dreamtime Village
and Driftless Sacred Grove. And Mikkel's name is spelled M-I-E-K-A-L, and you can find him on Facebook. Can I share your phone number?
Sure. It's 608-625-4619.
Right. It's been very interesting to have you on. I'm really glad that you were able to give some time. I know tomorrow, on Saturday, is when you are at the farmer's market. And, of course, our show is on. It's pre-recorded right now. But it's on also at noon on Saturday. So sometimes people see me at the farmer's market.
And it doesn't help to say that I'll have fresh pears for sale at the farmer's market tomorrow.
No, because it'll already be tomorrow. Yeah. I've made that mistake. So, yeah, we are pre-recording this show. And this is Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson. We're on every Saturday at noon, talking about food, farming, gardening, all that kind of stuff. And thank you so much for tuning in to WDRT Community Radio from the ground up. And we'll talk to you again next week. Thanks, Mikkel.